Well, good afternoon and welcome to Talk of the Towns. We try to go beyond the headlines to make sense of the issues facing Maine communities, to share what works and to seek alternative solutions. Talk of the Towns is aired on WERU Community Radio since 1993, dedicated to the proposition that everyone benefits when we share our knowledge, our experience, our concerns, and our perspectives. We're about to practice the magic of community radio, in which those of us in our virtual studio and you who are listening create a kind of dialogue we hope will be of benefit to our friends, our neighbors, and colleagues. We're your hosts, Ron Beard and Liz Graves. We hope you'll stay with us for the next hour and talk of the towns. And a reminder, we are recording this show in advance and won't be taking any calls.
Good afternoon, everybody. We are glad to be here with the folks who are the conveners of Down East Restorative Justice. So we're talking about restorative justice on the show today. And listeners may have heard the phrase restorative justice, maybe in connection with the criminal justice system, especially with young people. That work is part of a much broader set of practices, and they're rooted in the deep truth of how interconnected we all are. Our words and actions impact everyone around us. So restorative practices, the bigger container, aim to strengthen our connection with each other so that mutual respect and dignity, inclusiveness and equality, and choice and voice can grow. Some of that beautiful language is with help from Down East Restorative Justice themselves. So thank you for that. And so our guests today are Kayla Gagnon, who's the Restorative Youth and Community Coordinator for Down East Restorative Justice, and Leslie Ross, the Program and Case Coordinator for that organization. So we're so excited to be together. And what we do at the top of each show, for lots of reasons, and one of them is to peg voices to names so listeners can get a sense of who's talking, is that we'll ask each of you to just tell us a little bit about yourselves. We usually start all the way with, where did you grow up? And in this case, anything you want to say about how you encountered this work and what other things you've gotten into in your time and how it may be connected. Kayla, kick us off if you would. Welcome.
Yeah, thank you so much. I'm so grateful to be here. I grew up in a small rural town in Rhode Island, and I moved up to Mount Desert Island when I was 20 to start school at College of the Atlantic. After that, I lived out on Great Cranberry Island, moved to the Southwest, then to the Pacific Northwest, and then eventually came back here. And I've been in this area for a little over 10 years now. Encountering restorative justice in this work, I've been an activist since my youth. I knew about restorative justice, and I always associated it with work within prisons, dismantling the prison industrial complex. But I was much more educated in depth when I was out in Washington State with various activist groups and seeing how expansive the work really is, and how it touches all parts of the world, how it's a way of consciously being in the world, not just a way to respond to the harms done. And I think most, if not all, of my experiences in life have complemented this work, from, you know, firsthand encounters myself with the juvenile court systems as a teen that did not serve me, to doing community-based work with various groups and nonprofits, being a survivor of abuse within my own family and wishing there were alternatives to address that harm and support my healing, facilitating support circles for survivors, working in migrant communities on the border and in Mexico, working with children and elders, living on Great Cranberry Island, where I saw how addressing harm is not outsourced and addressed in the community itself, you know, living in intentional co-housing, really just being in relationship in general where conflict is inevitable, and learning how to navigate that so repair can happen and connection can be maintained.
Well, there's lots of fun stuff to dig into. Leslie, welcome. Tell us a bit about yourself.
Thank you. It's really, really a pleasure to be here. So, biography, I guess. So my childhood was in Turkey. My father was from the west coast of Canada. My mother from North Africa. I emigrated to Canada when I was 10 via a year in France, where I did most of my, you know, went through my high school and my whatever bit of post-secondary work I did, and then moved to New York City in the mid-80s as a young person. My first 5 years here were undocumented, but when I got my green card, you know, just realizing, okay, well, I actually really am living here. It took still, however, about another 20 years for me to get my citizenship, which was really like, stop pretending you don't live here and get your citizenship. So my years in the city, so I was in New York City for about 30 years and active both as I'm also an instrument maker and a musician. So I was very active in what was called the downtown, you know, new music world, and did a lot of work with choreographers and musicians and theater folks, where improvisation was always like a central component. So I was also very, very involved in community gardens on the Lower East Side, my whole time there. And so that was my connection to actually the broader community beyond just the artistic community that I was part of. And in that work, both working, yeah, just that community building was how restorative justice, in a way, just realizing there's so many, just like Kayla, just so many aspects of it that have been part of my life until, you know, until the moment I a name was put on it. So a fair amount of work with community gardens, which included working with both actually a lot of programs, setting up programs with youth, but also just like, you know, running, being part of like the collective that making community gardens work. And I was very early on, a de facto conflict resolution person there. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I guess I just want to say one thing about like those years in the city is it was like the height of the stop and frisk years. And with all the programs that we were running in the garden, and just because this is the language of grants, you know, for at-risk youth, there was this sore absence of work with kids once they were justice impacted. And that was actually the point at which I was made aware of restorative justice.
Yeah. So I'm already going to go off script before the next thing I plan to ask to follow up something from Leslie, because I think it might help continue to sort of ground us. I was thinking this morning about like, man, we're having a circle, but we're not having a circle with the four of us in our virtual studio today and with our listeners. So Leslie, say something if you would. This seems like a great way in about what you just said about improvisation. When you're with your being a musician, and in order to successfully improvise, in order for improv to be satisfying, there are some things about the way you need to show up. And I suspect that has a lot in common with the way folks are asked to show up to circles.
It does. I mean, in the sense that you show up present, like really present, to be able to have a sense of what is going on. Do you have a sense of what's going on around you? And you show up with responsibility too, because you're responsible for anything you put out there. And that responsibility is twofold, right? It's like, it's the responsibility in the moment, and it's that responsibility to be present in the moment. That's
okay. Yeah. Thank you. I love it. So where we're going to start, maybe with that grounding, is to ask Kayla, what do we mean by the terms restorative practice and restorative justice?
Yeah. So restorative justice, restorative practices are viewing relationships from a truly holistic perspective with the intention to bring social healing and non-adversarial community-based justice. It recognizes how we are all connected, how all of our actions, all of our behaviors affect the whole. And restorative work, as we call it now, is not a new concept. These are indigenous practices that our ancestors practice that have been kept alive by indigenous people today. And for that reason, we are indebted to and acknowledge that the indigenous roots of circle keeping here in Maine remains a continuous living practice amongst the Wabanaki Confederacy. And restorative justice, restorative practices, they emphasize that we, again, we are all connected, we're interdependent on one another, that any harm in community, it affects the whole, and it looks to help create alternative pathways for us to address real harm that fractures our relationships, to connect, to repair, to heal, in order to maintain healthy relationships and healthy communities. And it's a way to address that harm within our own communities without outsourcing with the need of law enforcement, punishment, or a power over dynamic that is, you know, restorative work. It's based on the foundation of mutual respect. And I heard a phrase at a convening that we had with restorative practitioners throughout the state. It was this facilitator from this group, Collective Justice in Seattle. And he said, the goal is to create a healer in every home. And I think that just beautifully captures what this work is intended to do. Restorative practices, they're the tangible tools that we use to cultivate community building that we can all use. And if we wish to have reconciliation, if a rupture happens first, we really need to restore that relationship. If I can go a little bit deeper, I wanted to say, like, being in circle is very intentional and probably one of the most fundamental and crucial parts of the work, I think, because it's about creating an equitable space together where no one, has more power over another person. We're able to see each other fully without, a table in between us. And that creates connection, vulnerability. And another important practice in that is the talking piece. And some folks can maybe see this as like juvenile or unnecessary, but it's very intentional. And it helps slow things down to be present, to be actively listening. Many times we're not fully listening to each other as we're always thinking about how we want to respond, and we'll interject and get really excited or really heated. And that having the talking piece, it really helps create a way for all voices to be heard equally.
When you say talking piece, you mean a physical object that if you're talking, you're holding it? Okay.
Stone, a stick. Sometimes in schools we'll use like a stuffed animal or a squishy thing, or it can be any piece that is chosen to pass around. So all those voices can be heard. So the louder voices or the more confident voices of interjecting aren't the ones that are predominantly heard. And as it comes around, folks always have the ability to pass. They don't need to say anything, but they know it will come to them. And if they choose to, they can share. And they know when sharing, they can take their time. They're not going to be interrupted. They don't need to, fight to be heard or think about how they need to be interjecting their voice to be a part of the conversation. It really allows a space of sharing to happen more naturally rather than forcing it.
Right. I'm gonna ask the question just because I know listeners will have heard the phrase restorative justice, and they will be thinking about the criminal justice system. So just place these circles in a context. I'm assuming that there's been some kind of rupture in the community that might be healed by bringing people together. Is that a good way to describe the broader concept of restorative justice that you're representing? And we'll come back to the criminal justice system in a minute, but I want to kind of place this for our listeners a little bit. Kayla, am I right in assuming some of that?
Yes, definitely. It is a way to bring the community together very intentionally, and we'll go into this later, when harm occurs. And I would say the more broader aspect, though, is even before harm occurs,
okay,
is community building is creating intentional spaces for us to have spaces to have difficult conversations, to connect over mutual experiences, just a space to even have our like staff meetings or community gatherings in circle, in a space with a container of having a talking piece, having values and agreements. That is a key component of when we create a space. Every time we have a circle, we have a talking piece, and we have values and agreements that we co-create together. Yep. So we'll all offer a value to honor while we're in the space together, and then we'll co-create group agreements, which can be changed and altered at any time during the circle if folks want to add something. And this is also important because, again, it's helping cultivate this sense of power together, power with versus power over, that we together are deciding how we want to be in this space, what parameters we want to have, how we want to respect each other, and that we collectively will hold each other accountable to those things.
Great. And I'll just remind listeners, because we're a quarter of the way through the hour, that they're tuned to Talk of the Towns. We're talking about the broad concept of restorative practice and restorative justice. Our guests include Kayla Gagnon, who is the restorative youth and community coordinator in the Downeast region, and Leslie Ross, who is program and case coordinator for the Downeast region. So, Liz, back to you.
Yeah. So I want to continue to ground. This does feel like we've gotten the flow well, by turning to Leslie to ask about, again, Kayla mentioned what we've both talked so far already about, being one of the big goals, being as fully present as we can. And Kayla acknowledged the keepers and the ongoing nature of this work from Indigenous communities from all over, is including here. And you, Leslie, have this beautiful statement on your bio on the organization's website about that groundedness. And you say that you inherited from your familial elders strong visions of the possibility of a just world and just communities of inclusion, compassion, and dialogue. So tell us a little bit more. That sounds so yummy. how that vision was built in you, and why it's important to ground this work.
And of course, it's like so complicated and layered. It's sort of like stories within stories within stories. And like, a little bit more around that is just like, both from both sides of my family, I am at least, a third generation that was born into a culture from which I wasn't part of, and a culture that was not part of my parents' culture. So either of the parents, each on their own. So like, again, several generations of this. And so from this mismatch, of displacement that this displacement creates in what's inherited culture and what's acquired culture, these are where the stories are. And if you want, if nothing else, they're sort of like stories of resilience, or what we would call resilience now, is just like through displacement and trauma and harm, both personal and societal. In my experience, like what I did inherit from my parents and my grandparents, is that, this resilience really came from the ways they remained open and trusting, mm-hmm. and curious and generous and fair. And this they did by modeling. So not from discussion, because they were stated like, these are the values we are behind. This is just the way that they were navigating in the world. Neither of my parents ever finished high school. My grandparents didn't even finish elementary school. And yet, despite this, in their curiosity and actually deep pleasure they had in their curiosity, they were avid readers and attuned to what was going on around them. Around them directly, around them in the world. Newspaper headlines were conversation at breakfast and lunch and dinner tables. And they were particularly attuned to the wrongs and injustices of the world. My mother went back to school when I was a teen and got her started teaching. And she was kind of at the same time also became really involved with the union. She considered herself, an anarcho-syndicalist, believed strongly in like collective self-determination. And like the, how just how this was just so much part of how she, I guess I just want to say, like, despite all the displacement, if there was one common thread also is that they were always able to connect with community that was around them, despite all their differences. And yeah, in those differences, and perhaps because of those differences, I knew them to be, you know, just, as I said, like, just always curious. Like, we could literally bring anyone home ever, always. Always generous. There was always room for more people at the table, impromptu or not. So there, yeah, that generosity, that openness, that fairness, and also that understanding that the political and the personal are completely enmeshed and intertwined.
And that's what I wanted. I want to just call out something I heard for us all to chew on, and I don't need anyone, no one needs to respond right now, but I suspect it'll come up as the conversation goes on, which is this idea that, like, there's a Christian mystic named Henry Nouwen, who wrote a book called The Wounded Healer, and talks about how personal or community or family healing is always linked to collective healing and processes. So it's just kind of fascinating to me that we were thinking, have thought mostly about circles that have an individual focus or an individual person or small human community, like a school or a family, and ideas about the way the world is versus the way that it should be or that we'd like it to be are also part of how we do that individual work and vice versa. So it's a
great. And you, as a former reporter, you have that instinct of going to the story and then connecting it to the broader community. I'm speaking to Liz as my colleague there. Kayla, could you talk a little bit? You've given us a really good grounding for the concept of the circle. What are some of the applications that might be useful for listeners to kind of see how you might introduce a circle and how would you use it over time? Please.
Yeah. So I'll start with all circles, regardless of their purpose or intention, are always community building circles. Yep. Anytime we're coming together, we're building community, we're creating connection. So we have one avenue of utilizing circles specifically within restorative justice is our community resolution process. So we'll facilitate a harm repair circle. And so I think that's what most people think of when they hear restorative justice. And these circles, they have the most prep work. We don't just put folks who were harmed and folks who did harm together in a room together to have a conversation. We'd have multiple preliminary meetings to make sure the person who did the harm does wish to take full accountability and that the person who was harmed is not looking for punishment of the other. And all of our processes, all circles at all points are 100% voluntary. And if someone does not wish to be accountable for their actions, this process is not for them. And if, again, at any point someone wishes to pause or not be a part of the process, they can fully back out. And also if later they decide they want to try again, we are always here to reopen the process for them. Essentially, no one ever has an obligation to participate. And yeah, you know, typically the harm repair circles, they will have also a repair agreement that all participants in the opening circle, when we all get together, and that will look like, it can look different for every circle, of course. The individual who is harmed, their support people, the person who did the harm, their support people, and others can be added as well, community, volunteer. And together, all participants co-create and have mutual consensus around a repair agreement. Because again, this work, it's about equalizing power. It's about no one having, you know, a louder voice than another. And when we create the repair agreement, it's, you know, it's imperative that it's also reasonable and attainable for the individual who did the harm to be able to complete it. And that's where, you know, with youth and with adults, we'll pair them with a community volunteer to, you know, meet with them once a week just to support them. Say like, hey, how is this going? And also really, more importantly, I think, to remind them that they are still connected to the community, that the community cares. They're not being ostracized by the community. They're not being seen as, you know, you are the worst thing that you have done, that they are still being held by the community.
Could you just give us a really quick example? No confidentiality involved, but what would that kind of agreement look like? Could you think of an example where that agreement resulted in the kind of full support of the circle?
Yeah. I mean, they all do. They all result in the full support of the circle. Even if it takes a lot of time to come to that, but it can look so different depending on every individual, but more or less, I would say things like with youth specifically, you know, going to school and keeping good grades, doing X amount of hours of community service, sometimes writing an apology letter, things like that are some of the things that will come up in a repair agreement. But we also have, you know, that's one area of circles. We also have support and accountability circles and other support circles, which can also be like a tandem process that happens while we have a harm repair circle. So a support circle can support, you know, the individual that was harmed with their support people and or the individual who did the harm, having a support circle, especially when it becomes known that they themselves have experienced a great amount of harm and need support during this process of taking accountability. And then also support and accountability circles where maybe the individual who was harmed wishes not to participate, but the individual who did harm still wants to take accountability and wants to learn and grow and heal. And so we'll hold a process for them as well.
Great. Thank you. Those are great examples or great kind of helping listeners understand why these circles are important and how they're used. Liz,
can I ask about a couple of other categories? So you mentioned there are some circles convened that focus on wellness or recovery projects. How do those go?
Yeah. So we facilitate multiple community circles and hope to continue to do more. So one that has been ongoing for quite some time now with collaboration originally with Healthy Acadia is our Circle of Care, which is a virtual circle that happens every third Wednesday of the month. And it's for care providers of any type, you know, recovery coaches, social workers, hospice workers, really anybody that's working with community and giving. It's a space for them to come together, to be supported, and, you know, talk about different topics. And then I facilitate a monthly community circle at the Northeast Harbor Library, and we're going on its second year now. And this year it will be the second Thursday of each month from 4:30 to 5:30. And that topic changes each month, but it's centered around difficult topics to discuss, kind of more charged topics where we in our community very well may have a difference of opinion, just to come in together and, yeah, discuss those things. And then we also facilitate a wellness circle at the Inspire Center in Ellsworth. This is biweekly from 2 to 3 p.m. And this circle has been so enjoyable and soul nourishing for me. This kind of came out of a grant that allowed us to do restorative practice and restorative justice trainings with Healthy Acadia Home in Orland and the Emmaus Shelter. And we've just been continuing to collaborate with them. So this circle at Inspire came out of that. And again, all three are free and open to the public. You know, we'll always gratefully accept donations, but for folks to show up and come and connect, we would be so grateful for more folks to come into the community circles that we're holding.
Liz, go ahead.
Oh, I was gonna, those were the, What are the hallmarks, would you say, of a circle that's going well?
Yeah, so it's kind of hard to say because the goal as a facilitator is always to not have an outcome in mind, which is very difficult, especially in harm repair. We usually want to lead people to a certain way to achieve like healing or resolution. But that is not, you know, the intention of facilitating these circles. It's for the community to create the container, navigate it as it flows, wherever it flows, and it can go anywhere. It's a co-created space that we are just kind of holding and modeling and helping make sure that it has a flow, but again, with no intended outcome. All that to say, I think, you know, it's really satisfying and makes us feel like a circle is going well when there's engagement. When people are engaging, when caring, being brave and vulnerable, that is so rewarding.
Liz, I'll just break in again and remind listeners who we're listening to. This is Talk of the Towns. Liz Graves and I, Ron Beard, are your hosts. We're talking about the concepts of restorative justice and restorative practice with the staff of Downeast Restorative Justice. You've just heard from Kayla Gagnon, who is the Restorative Youth and Community Coordinator. It's hard to get all that out. Sorry. And Leslie Ross, the Program and Case Coordinator. Liz, go ahead.
Sure. Where I think we were maybe going to go next is to ask for some more specifics on that thing that we keep saying people have heard about, is the collaboration with the State Department of Corrections for work with youth. And maybe Leslie, do you want to take the first stab?
And I will. And if I may, I might end up like, you know, going not sticking to the collaboration with the court system and the Department of Corrections.
Okay.
Just picking back on, Kayla did give a brief outline of what our harm repair processes are. And truly, there is not much of a difference between whether or not that referral comes from the juvenile justice, our juvenile corrections officers or the court, or whether that referral comes from a community member.
But I can say
like some of the, where there are clear differences, right? And then again, Kayla really just mentioned them, is that when we hold our harm repair processes, we aim for a collective agreement on how we are to move forward. And of course, this is very different from any justice system, which basically tells people what's going to happen. And if you go even deeper into it, and even when we're talking about going to trial and having a jury, it's still a decision that is coming from people who are not intimately affected or connected to an incident. So either for that person harmed, the victim, if you want, and for the person who caused that harm, the person who made that violation. So, I don't know. I think Kayla really covered, you know, an important part of any harm repair process, wherever it comes from, is that it is not rushed. When we are talking, and of course, the more significant the impact of the harm, the more significant the trauma, the more you want to really take things like baby steps by baby steps. This is including with people who are saying that they want to do this. So this is even if somebody is stating that, yes, they want to go through this process and they are the person harmed. We take our time with them just to be sure that they are really in a place where they would like to speak with this other person. And everyone on all the parties have their own, and Kayla again alluded to this too, is that often there's some like little parallel processes that might happen. And sometimes those parallel processes can happen over a protracted period of time. Mm-hmm. And for the person who caused the harm, it's just like, you know, just what does actually taking accountability look like? What does ownership look like? And just because somebody says that they are sorry, or that they acknowledge that they did this, if they're not in a place to be able to actually hear the impact of the harm that they had on another individual, we will not put them in the conversation. So an important part of the harm repair work, whether it comes from the Department of Corrections or community referrals, is, as Kayla said again, that prep work and making sure that people are ready to speak with each other.
Yeah.
That makes sense. I hadn't thought of it. Kayla mentioned that folks can opt out and then maybe back in sometimes, that it makes sense to me that if I were, say, the person harmed in an incident, I might at first think, yeah, cool, this is great, I'm up for doing a circle. And then it might be really hard, or, you know, like it might be something might be not as I expected or scary, or and then I might need to take a break. That I can imagine that.
Right. And if a version of that can happen is not so much taking a break from the individual, or I mean, it is, but then we continue to work with that person through them being able to process moving through whatever emotions they have over what it is that they've done, so that they can get to the other side of it to be able to acknowledge it.
Yeah.
And I guess this is perhaps where it does differ when we're working with the Justice Department, is that as much as we say we do not have an intended outcome in mind, I mean, of course, we want resolution. That's why we do this work. We seek resolution, but we seek resolution by supporting the dialogue. So this is a very, very important distinction between the work that we do as facilitators and how mediation works, is we do not offer items for that repair agreement. You know, we do not offer, you know, there's sometimes when we're explicitly asked at some of our preliminary meetings, we might give some suggestions, but we make it very clear that this is something that has to come from the individuals themselves. And one thing I just want to say about those repair agreements is they can be incredibly imaginative. And it just really depends on, the needs of the people involved. And they're often, even with Department of Corrections referrals, they're, you know, which has, especially with juveniles, and to be clear, we take adult cases as well from the courts. But there are very clear restrictions on what a youth can be asked to do for a court. And in circle, however, there can be some asks of the person harmed that would never happen in court, that would not be allowed in court. But if everybody agrees in the circle, it is something that can happen. I don't know if that answered.
Yeah, it does. I'm curious. I'm always curious about the structure of things. I'm a wonk. So like it's not the heart of the circles, but I am curious both for youth and adults, like at what point in a criminal justice proceeding would this off ramp happen?
All right. So for with youth, that off ramp can happen very early. That off ramp, because when a youth is arrested, the police is involved, summons is issued, remember if it's called a summons, whatever it is, goes both to the juvenile corrections officer and to the DA's office. So they receive that report at the same time. And the juvenile corrections officer is integral to what next step might be. And often the juvenile corrections officer, even before it gets processed to in court at all, has that conversation and just says, you know, I'm wanting to refer this to restorative justice. And when we get a case like that, it's called an informal action. And basically it means that if the youth completes a restorative process successfully, then there's no further action. It doesn't go to court. So if you want, it stops at the juvenile corrections office.
Mm-hmm. And so the prosecutor has to agree with that call?
The prosecutor has to agree with that call. But most of the time, there are only a couple of times when that has really been an ongoing, like a needed to be a real conversation. Mm-hmm. when it gets to that place where it's a real conversation and the person's already somehow in the court system, then we still get referrals that are either part of it's the juvenile version of deferred disposition, which I don't remember exactly what it is, but it's basically the youth admitting to doing whatever it was that they admitted to in court, and the successful completion of a restorative process would make that would basically close that case as successful, and it would not, there would not be any charge on records mm-hmm. at all about it. Mm-hmm. So that, and with adults, it does usually come with, it does come as part of a deferred disposition. Just to say we're still working on getting our adult cases back up and running. We are open to, thing is that we're open to community referrals. We're open to diversion referrals from police departments. This has been an ongoing conversation that hasn't quite solidified, but we've been at the cusp of a number of times. So that same kind of discretion that can happen in the court where it's restorative justice becomes part of the deferred disposition, discretion could possibly be part from as part of a decision made within a police department. So instead of like summonsing you and sending you to court, there is this option too. Yeah. And, but with all of these cases, I mean, again, just kind of going back to what Kayla said, is that it has to be voluntary. Like, so it has to be voluntary and on the part of the person who caused the harm, there has to be ownership, which is again, so opposite of what you do when you go to court. You go to court to say you're not guilty, right? So it just sets up this dynamic of opposition. And our dynamic is not one to set up a dynamic of opposition, but to open that conversation mm-hmm. to see what each party needs for their own healing and for it, for you know, them to be able to move mm-hmm. forward yeah. in community.
Oh, super hard to believe, but we are already just about three quarters through our time. So I'll remind listeners that might just be joining us that you're listening to Talk of the Towns on WRU Community Radio. And we were just hearing from Leslie Ross, who's one of the staff of Down East Restorative Justice. And we're also here with Kayla Gagnon. Really fruitful conversation so far. Bron, where do you want to go next?
Well, we might just ask about how things are organized. How are you as Down East Restorative Justice organized? How do you have staff positions? You know, those kinds of details. So listeners might kind of glom onto that and kind of say, oh, now I understand how I might support Down East Restorative Justice. Kayla, do you want to start?
Well, we're a very grassroots organization, and I feel deeply grateful to say that we're a worker self-directed nonprofit, meaning that we don't have hierarchy. We have no executive directors. All employees are also board members. All of our decision-making processes are based on mutual consensus all of the time. Our handbook, policies, bylaws, they're living documents that can be changed. And our employee contracts and mutual agreements to our colleagues are ways that we hold each other accountable to the work that we do, but also have grace with each other that we are human beings navigating this world. And the organization of a worker self-directed nonprofit, I would say, is not for everybody. You know, some people really need parameters or like to be told what to do. But for folks that are like self-motivated and collaborative, a worker self-directed environment is, like for me, is really ideal because I don't like having people tell me what to do or having power over me, I should say. So in terms of our structure, again, it's truly restorative where all voices are seen as equal. And that being in a restorative workplace really, things move much slower. Things take a lot longer, but that's the paradigm shift, you know, of we're not looking for productivity and time and one size fits all. It's really about taking our time and adjusting. It's about relationships, moving at the speed of trust. And so I would say in terms of folks, getting involved. Again, like all of our circles are free and open to the public. We welcome donations. Our community resolution circles have a sliding scale fee, but we'll never turn someone away for lack of funds. We do a lot of volunteer trainings. We'll do, not seasonally, but bi-seasonally, spring and fall, we'll do free workshops where it'll be an info session. What is restorative justice? What the heck do we do in DRJ? And then a deeper training into preparing folks to be able to be community volunteers to support an individual who has caused harm in a harm repair process. And then if folks wish, after being a community volunteer or taking the community volunteer training, we'll have deeper trainings for facilitation. So folks wish to become community facilitators that we can call upon when we need, you know, support, because right now it's just Leslie and I as official employees, and we have other community facilitators. But again, building that network for folks to be able to come and co-facilitate a harm repair process with us. Yeah, so we actually just had our fall training, and we'll do another one in the spring. So folks should look out for when that is. And because we serve all of Hancock County, we like to, you know, try to do it in different places and spaces, but usually Ellsworth is the meeting center. So we'll usually hold these workshops in Ellsworth. The other big thing I want to mention is we have a community board. So again, our board is open to anybody that wishes to come and sit in and, you know, see if it's something that interests them to then be a part of the community board. And we have, we have monthly or quarterly meetings. And again, we would love more community board members, as something that we are really needing and wanting to build. Restorative justice and restorative practices cannot thrive and cannot function without the involvement of community. So to have more folks come in and participate and support us by being a part of the community board, and maybe even folks that have experience or skills in grant writing and fundraising. Just a shout out to anyone listening who maybe you know someone who would be interested in this work that has those skill sets. That is something that we could really use some support in.
So I'm gathering then that the way that you're funded is through those two means, by fundraising, asking people for help in supporting the organization, and specific grants where you're writing to get some support for a particular project. Is that right?
Yes. And I would say our primary funding, however, is through the Department of Corrections.
Okay,
the
great cases
Thank you. That are referred to us through the Department of Corrections, that is our primary funding. Yeah.
Great. Thanks.
Yeah.
Well, we've got 10 minutes left or so. Liz, where do you want to take the conversation?
Oh, my goodness. Okay. Well, I want to go back to skipped over something I was hoping to do, which is we talked a little bit about examples of harm repair circles. Something that was surprising to me getting ready for this conversation is that there are, in addition to the Department of Corrections work, there are also harm repair circles, often with young folks, but not always, that come out of, that a request comes from a school or from a workplace. So I was wondering if we could talk some, like a general example of one of those. I've heard about how does that get set up?
So there could be I can go a couple of different ways with what those circles might look like. And I was very specifically with schools, harm repair circles are, again, they're sometimes in lieu of expulsion or connected to expulsion. So it's part of a reentry. So there's been an infraction, sometimes physical, sometimes an assault, sometimes repeated, use, bringing substances to school. We will hold, there's almost never a harm repair circle connected to a school that is not also a support and accountability circle. And I'm sorry, I am going to backtrack a little bit on the harm repair and just say another important part of when we have folks in the together in a circle, one of the things that we discover in our preliminary meetings with all the parties, right? But when with our preliminary meeting with the person harmed, we discover just how much harm they are trying to heal from. We discover just how many unmet needs they have. And that's where we will start holding parallel processes for support, for accountability and support, to try and see if we can meet needs somehow. And this sometimes means going out, of course, of DRJ and trying to find the necessary supports. And the reason for that is that, especially if the harm they committed is of more, has more impact, we don't, when we have our harm repair circles, the focus is on the incident of harm. And we can't bring into that circle mm-hmm. the harm of the person who caused the harm. Mm-hmm. So that's I guess.
Right. If you branch out too much, it gets harder and harder to resolve. Yeah.
And it's not, it wouldn't be right by the person who was harmed mm-hmm. to have to also then be part of that conversation. I mean, some may choose to, but it wouldn't be something to ask of them. So when it comes to referrals from schools, there's always a support element. Because and these include expulsions or repeated truancy or expulsions because of assaults or expulsions because of repeatedly coming in under the influence or bringing in drugs or alcohol, but also things like truancy will come up. And then one big difference with the support circles is that it's not like we don't have a repair agreement, we have an action plan. And that action plan, it's the same thing. It's done consensually with every participant. And some of that plan is about what that person can do for themselves, what they can do as repair, how they can use their strengths to move through what it is that they're needing to move through. But it's also an action plan for others to take action. Like, where are the supports that you need is a question that's asked. And then other people in the circle will volunteer or offer, well, I can take this role on. And then this becomes part of the action plan. So it's an action plan for everyone, not just the person, who's sort of like the centerpiece, so to speak, of the conversation. And then the other thing, because it's an action plan, with our repair agreements, we usually have a projected end date. With action plans, we go from check-in to check-in to check-in until we're at a place where we feel, I think we can come to a close. So those meetings can be a lot more regular. They can be like usually biweekly as opposed to weekly, but certainly not less than once a month. I mean, yeah, not less than once a month. So that's the kind of referral we get from schools. We have had a community-based referral for an accountability process around sexual harm. And this is, again, a community that came to us because they were concerned about the behavior of a person. In their community. This person was open to our process. In the process, we were approached also by some of the folks that were involved, that were harmed by this person's actions. And they were supportive of the process, though they were not wanting to take an active role in it. So this is an example of some of the cases that we get that aren't coming from the Department of Corrections.
That's super helpful. And it made me think, I'm actually not positive exactly how much time we have, but I'm curious about closing circles. Like in okay. thinking about it seems so, okay, great. Thank you. I remember I was in a circle once and the facilitator taught us a movement practice because the energy was just too sticky that we couldn't go to lunch. like nobody wanted to leave the circle. And I imagine that think this seems so life-giving that you would want to stay in the circle, and presumably in order to continue to do work and be available for other folks, you have to close circles. So how does that work?
Okay. We close circles, but nothing stops us from continuing to meet. You know, like nothing stops us from continuing to meet. And one of the things in our harm repair circles with youth, I mean, again, this is open to adults, and this is connected to our training, is that we will partner, if you want, the person who caused harm with what we call a community volunteer. And the role of the community volunteer is really to build connection and to support them through the harm repair agreement. But really to connect, right? So, and this, they might be meeting on a weekly basis for 2 months, 3 months, 6 months. And just because we close doesn't mean that relationship is done, right? And so, so there's nothing, there's a very different feel at successful closing than there is at openings.
You know? Yeah, great. That's a great one part of the answer is that if a part of the goal of the work is to build and nurture connections, then of course the connections endure when that's awesome. So we are very close to out of time and we're going to go to our final lightning round, which is also how we close every show, which is just briefly, a sentence or so. What's the one thing that you wish was better understood about this work? And whoever wants to go first, just whoever feels ready. Kayla Yuva.
It's just hard to put it into a sentence.
Yes.
I just wish people knew how broad and expansive restorative work is and how deeply life-changing it can be for people, whether it's a community circle, harm repair process, being in true community. And I say true community, like not seeing people as disposable, seeing people as, as worth time to give, to listen to and to change. And that really, it is at its core, it's love. It's just love.
Yeah. Okay, Leslie. Final word.
That was beautiful. So, as part of our harm repair work, we always talk about making something as right as possible, right? Like when there has been a wrong that needs to be righted. And actually, it's just like what it comes down to for me when we're thinking about restorative justice, is just really how can we do right by each other all the time, right? So not just we've done wrong, how can we do right by each other all the time? How can we be like accepting and loving and curious with each other all the time is really for me the foundation of what restorative justice is.
Thanks, Leslie. So we've come to the end of an hour. My goodness, it's gone so fast. Be sure and join us from 4 to 5 on the second Wednesday afternoon of each month for Talk of the Towns. Podcasts of our programs can be found in the archive section of the WERU website. If you have comments or suggestions for new topics, please email us at news@weru.org. Our theme music is a medley from Coronach on a Balnane House Island music recording. Thanks to our guests in the studio from Down East Restorative Justice. Kayla Gagnon is the Restorative Youth and Community Coordinator, and Leslie Ross is the Program and Case Coordinator. Thanks to our underwriters. Thanks to Joel Mann for engineering our program and to College of the Atlantic for production help. Stay tuned for Ralph Nader Radio from 5 to 6 and 2 hours of jazz in Groove Shop from 6 to 8. Liz Graves and I are producers and hosts for Talk of the Towns. This is Ron Beard wishing you a good afternoon.